Hi, I'm Sunny Dean.
And I'm Scott Drakeford.
And this is the Publishing Rodeo Podcast. In 2022, we both launched debut novels in the same genre with the same publisher in the same year. But despite having very similar starts, our books and subsequently each of our careers went in very different directions.
That pattern repeats itself throughout the industry over and over. Why do some books succeed while others seem to be dead on arrival?
In this podcast, we aim to answer those questions and many more, along with how to build and maintain an author career.
Everyone signing a contract deserves to know what they're really signing up for. In an industry that loves its secrets, we'll be sharing real details from real people. We'll cover the gamut of life as a Big Five published author, from agents to publishing contracts, finances, and more.
Welcome to this week's Publishing Rodeo. If you are a regular listener, we've probably had a gap of about a month where we put episodes out, and that's just due to an editing backlog that's built up. So I'm not sure exactly when this one comes out in the rota, but we are kind of back and recording and doing things. And with us today is Ed Wilson, a literary agent, one of the very few that we've had on here, although we've interviewed about five of his clients, not intentionally, just, you know, the UK circle is quite small, I think. I really noticed this at the Strange Up North event, that everyone attending, all the authors, that either like a Harry client, an Ed Wilson client, or an Alex Cochran client, or Juliet Mushin. So it's a small circle in the UK, but we kind of, there's a range of issues I think we were going to cover, but first of all, we'll start off and let you introduce yourself, if that's okay, and how you got into agenting and so on.
Well, I'm not sure if I'm the only person who's actually emailed you to demand they come on the podcast, but I felt like once you'd reached a...
Oh no, we get that a lot.
This is it. You're a victim of your own success. You see, I felt like once you'd reached a critical mass of my clients that you'd spoken to, I don't think any of them have taken my name in vain, but I think I deserve a right to reply, even if they haven't. But no, so my name's Ed. I'm a literary agent at Johnson & Alcock. I have to do a potted history of myself. I'm one of the directors and I'm one of the co-owners of the agency here. We're an old agency. We've been going since the 1950s. So I look after lots of estates that have been around for a long, long time. So writers like Dick Francis, William Trevor, Beryl Bainbridge, Elizabeth Taylor, Barbara Cummins. So a lot of kind of literary greats. So that's kind of half of what I do. The other half are authors who are alive, which is wonderful. And science fiction and fantasy, horror have always been a big focus. I do literary stuff. I do crime and thriller. I do weird things. I like weird books. I have the old poet. Occasionally, like a playwright or a graphic novelist, slip through. But my current, my kind of best known authors are R.J. Barker, award winning, the man with the best hair in publishing. I look after Caoimhe MacDonald, who writes as C.K. MacDonald, who is Irish and one of the funniest men you'll ever meet. Of the people who've been on the podcast, Alex Darwin, Mark Stay as well, but also a crime writer called Robert Thorogood, who created Death in Paradise and is, and again, is just delightfully charming.
That's one of my comps for a pitch.
Is it? What, Death in Paradise?
Yeah. No one knows about it yet. It's a sci-fi thing that I've written a pitch for. And one of my comps is Death in Paradise meets kind of Black Mirror. Everyone uses Black Mirror as a comp. But yeah, anyway.
Death in Paradise meets Black Mirror. God, like Death in Hades. I like that. As you can tell, I've got quite broad taste. And the thing that attracts me, I like working with interesting creative people and I like to follow them wherever they go. So a lot of my writers write in different genres. A lot of my writers come up with mad ideas. Some of them are mad and brilliant and work. Some of them are mad and brilliant and don't work. And I enjoy the journey. I've been very lucky that my list is underpinned by backlist, which is something that younger agents, of which I don't think I count anymore, but younger agents don't have that. I've got a backlist so I can maybe take a few more risks. So that's me. Done. Is that over? The podcast is finished now.
So one of the things that we were talking about, I think, you know, you do listen to the podcast. My agent does not. I think he's a bit frightened.
Of course he does. Of course he does. He just doesn't admit it.
Oh, are you reckon? Okay. I'm not going to call him on that. But yeah, I was wondering if there was a perspective that you felt was missing, I guess, or anything that, I know this is like a broad question, anything you hear and you thought, oh no, they've got that really wrong, or, you know, they've missed a particular aspect of it.
So what within the podcast, anything you've got wrong? Yeah. That'd be quite a punchy opening gambit, wouldn't you? Just to like, I have a list, I have a spreadsheet of all of the things that you've been incorrect about. No, look, I think broadly speaking, like the mission statement of the podcast to demystify publishing, I'm completely behind. Like I there's a lot of stuff that for legal reasons, for the bits of paper that authors have signed, you cannot put out into the public domain. But I think we can talk more broadly about the shape of publishing, the things that work and the things that don't. I don't know that there's anything that you've specifically got wrong. The problem with publishing is that everybody has their own axe to grind. They have their own perspective and they have their own knowledge, and everybody has to argue from the particular. Very few people have the overview. I mean, God knows, Tom Weldon, CEO of PRH, he probably has a better overview than most, but he's not going to tell you. From my perspective, I think most of what you're trying to achieve is important, and I hope that aspiring writers listen to this and feel a bit more educated. So I'm not going to take you down. Not initially.
Okay.
You could try.
Scott's roaring for the fight.
We'll go down swinging. No, I unfortunately I quite like it already, so we won't get any real fights. But
there's time, Scott. There's plenty of time.
Damn you for being charming. Yeah, I mean, so one thing you said, I just want to call out as being a big positive from the author side, right? Following authors wherever they go. That's, I think, every author's dream, right? Is to write whatever they want and have their agent partner with them. But Sunyi, you know, I want to talk about the debut advance stuff. I want to talk about the, you know, author pay, et cetera. So if I'm not mistaken, you mentioned something in your email to Sunyi about big debut advances and how big debut advances are not always the right move for an author and their career. Would you like to clarify that and give us your stance, and then we'll dig in and argue a little bit?
Well, look, it's a structural thing, right? So as an agent, I've got multiple authors. Now, this may come as a shock to some of my writers. Sadly, I do represent more than one person. So you look at the way that it's possible for me to make my business function. So yeah. I get my commission on multiple advances. Now, if one advance is huge, then I get my chunk is bigger, and that's a good thing. But I have multiple opportunities. So if one of those books doesn't work, my eggs aren't in that basket solely. For an author, your book is your thing. It's the only thing that you've got functioning at that time. Mm-hmm. So while it's good to get remunerated I'm never going to say that an author should turn down a lot of money, but I think that it's not always the right thing for that money to be to create an imbalance for them to be overpaid by a publisher. And quite often I see particularly a younger writer who has a lot of money thrown at them, and that causes as much damage as the obvious benefit that being rich will do. Now, from an agent's perspective, and particularly there are some agents who don't invest in their writers for the long term, the fact that an author may get completely thrown out of kilter by having a huge amount of money, that doesn't matter to them because they've got lots of other authors who they can follow and lots of other revenue streams. Whereas you have a writer who can be completely cast adrift. Name another industry where you're expecting to get your biggest paycheck on day one.
Yeah, that is
odd. If you can imagine that imagine that in any other industry, I'm sure the music industry is all over the place, but even then there's a sense that you would build up to it. So I would much rather my authors get paid well, but they have an achievable advance that they can earn out that they get paid more the next time rather than starting big and potentially working down.
Okay, I guess I've got two questions. The first is, what is achievable? And the second is, like, for me, I mean, maybe because I'm not young and I think about, like, my kids and I think about money in terms of surety, like if God came down from heaven, said, hi, hello, I'm real, here's irrefutable proof. And obviously the first thing God would do is come and talk to me about book advances. You're going to get offered a 7-figure book deal. If you sign it, the book will bomb and you'll never publish trad again. Or you can sign a mid-list deal and you might have a career. I would take the 7-figure deal because I don't give a flying shit. Like, if you give me $1 million and you don't sell the book, that's your fucking problem as a publisher. I'm just going to go and invest it.
Yeah.
So for me, it's hard to, like, I hear what you're saying about the career stuff. And I think it probably depends. Like, if you're choosing between, say, like 200K and 120, it's really different. But if it's like 40K and 300K, for me, there's not as much contest, but I don't know. Anyway, I'm interested in what you think on achievable advance.
Sorry, Scott is actually vibrating. He's so excited to say something. I don't know what it's going to be.
You go first.
No. But okay. I can see you're quivering with excitement. Come on, hit me.
Totally agree. So, how many mid-list authors ever get seven figures? So, assuming it is a seven figure versus, you know, even low six figure, right? How many low six figure first advances ever get to seven figures in their career? How many mid-list ever get to even probably mid six figures in their career in terms of advance money or just total money earned? So I think that's a very good point, Sunyi. But before I go go ahead.
I think that has to be the aim. I mean, I don't know that I can't give you number. I can't give you a specific percentage of my list who've graduated and gone up. But certainly that is the structure that I think is sustainable. You're building something sustainable for an author.
Sure.
If the trajectory is the other way, it's not just about the money. It's also about the mental well-being of that writer. So it's very well to say I'd take $1 million and then I'm happy for the book to completely bomb. Mm-hmm. Because my career is going to be fine after that, and I've bought myself a house and whatever. But you as a writer, your creative self is going to be completely fucked by that. And any creative individual who says I'm going to take all the money, I'm going to watch my creative endeavor fail, and I'm going to be just fine by that is lying. You can't do that.
No, it would be hard, but I think that I feel like failure is just as likely or not more likely on a lower advance. And I think for me, I would look at it as like, well, if the book bombs, I can always self-publish. Like, there are no barriers to publishing anymore.
But that's it's about visible failure as well. I think that's part of it, is because the industry is obsessed with screaming about these six-figure deals, these seven-figure deals, it means that you're visibly failing. Okay. I mean, there's an example from the 2000s, an author called Gautam Akani, who was one of Andrew Wiley's like early million-dollar sales. And that book, Londonistani, did relatively little. Now, I don't know what that writer does now, because that writer is no longer part of it. I feel like they published something relatively recently, but much smaller. Now, if you take that as a single example, how many of those do we not know about? How many people will write a book, it fails, and then they just don't want to do it again? That's like, how is how many people is the industry losing because the publishing has given them an irresponsible amount of money and they're not bothered to make them a success and support them when they're not?
So I think I hear two issues there, which is I do think that there's an issue with publishers giving out money in a like writing very silly checks and then just like not supporting the book. And I don't ever understand why they do that.
It's a game.
But I guess from the author side, for me, it always comes down to like any book can fail. But my main concern beyond the art is making sure that I have enough money to support essentially my youngest, who is probably going to be in assisted living for his whole life, which is quite expensive. And so I think my goals, and that may be very specific to me, are have I done the one thing that I can do to make money that will help him not be confined to like a really horrible state? Like institution. But yeah, I do think that there's like, I guess for me, a separate issue with why are big checks written for books sometimes? I think it was Keshen or Discord is talking about like, why do they ever give seven figures to debuts? Can they actually earn that?
Yeah.
Well, because I mean, it's a risk, and usually there's been a kind of pissing contest between publishers to try and show who can do it. And I think that's kind of part of the game, and the part of the game that agents play is to try and encourage that kind of thing. Now, of those, how many of them actually end up with a proper brand author being established, somebody who's going to consistently sell at the level to sustain that advance? Very, very few. You know, and this is part of my publishing has no accountability. So you look at every single six, seven figure deal that's announced. How often do people, I mean, the publishers, obviously, they have their P&Ls and they know Jesus, look at that. Look at the unearned advance on that one. How did the rest of the industry go back and go, right, okay, how many good writers have written really good books and that we've basically blown out of the water? I think there is a responsibility to look after writers when they're debuts. Now, you look after them financially, and I think it's very important that writers should be paid a proper wage, a proper advance, but sometimes it becomes irresponsible.
I mean,
every agent is going to be screaming, like, shut up, Wilson. You know, we want as much money as possible. But sometimes I go, once I get to know my writers, I know the ones who really don't need that. You know, I can remember really early, I sold a sci-fi book for a good chunk of money. And I said to the author, look, the one thing, please don't quit your job. Like, this is a good amount of money. This is not going to change your life forever. Don't quit your job. It's all going to be fine. We're going to work out, and we want to get you to the point where you can just live off your writing. He quit his job straight away. Like, the first book did not perform how he went to, and he'd basically blown his life up. And there was no, I was there saying, come on. I'm trying to support you, trying to show you how to do this. Nobody at the publisher had any contact with him at all. When the book didn't do very well, nobody was there going, okay, we need to help this writer deal with the success that we promised him that has not been delivered. But nobody did. It falls on the agent. I mean, the agent's the only person who picks up the pieces. And a lot of agents don't bother. And that's part of my
concern.
So
there's that agent, I won't name him, he's quite famous, but he's known for having an approach where he says that if the client earns out their advance, he thinks he's not negotiated high enough. I take it you're not in that camp.
Yeah.
I mean, the same. I'm going to say, I think that's the same. Is it the same agent who said that if a publisher makes money out of a book, he hasn't done his job properly?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't think he said any of these things, but it sounds
so.
Sorry, so, Scott's quivering again. Come on, Scott.
I think we're talking about three different things, right?
Yeah.
And on two out of those three things, I agree with you, Ed. So one is a systemic view of publishing as an industry and the insanity that is handing a fuck ton of money to unproven books, to unproven authors, just to chase a trend. And like, we could all name at least a dozen books just in the last few years that were exactly this shit, right? So
in the last few weeks, I would say. Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
So I'm completely with you. The industry is very lopsided, and it's that way, in my opinion. Sorry, editors who I want to pay me a lot of money in the future, but it is that way, in my opinion, because the power is concentrated in a very small pool of people. And they're all competing with each other for these books, and they all have the same aim, but the decisions come down to a very small number of people when it comes to writing these checks. And so it happens frequently with what I would call poor due diligence, right? The second thing that you talked about, I would call career planning, right? And the point that I think you're making that could be put more succinctly is
Burn.
Publishers.
Ouch.
No. I'm sorry. I'm just
Scott.
I'm a summarizer, right? I'm trying to summarize.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, taking discussion into summary is always going to be more succinct, right?
And you get to edit it as well, so you can just cut me out and just keep your summary. God, you see this? This is
I don't edit anything.
This is Stalinist. Jesus, what have I come on?
Sunny edits everything, and she is not afraid of making me look dumb either. So you're in good company. Just kidding. Sunny's awesome, and she makes me look so much better than I really am.
Oh, look how he backtracks.
Bow to the queen. But what we're really talking about is career planning, and succinctly put, publishers are not your friend from a career perspective. Authors are gig workers. You are an Uber driver to them. And the minute that you are not the best Uber available, you are gone. You are just done. So I completely agree with you in terms of career planning. If you don't get an amount of money that sets you up for whatever amount of time you feel comfortable building your author career or something else, don't quit your job, right? It's not a stable industry. But that takes me to the third thing where I disagree with at least the tone of what's been discussed. And that is because everyone we've talked to, either on air or off air, has given me at least the subjective opinion that subsequent deals are not based on P&L. They are not based on sales relative to hype, sales relative to the contract given before. They are based purely on sales, right? And it, on previous sales and or, you know, the editor's opinion of whether this next thing is hot and whether it goes to auction. There are obviously other variables. But in terms of building on a previous contract for future contracts, as far as I know, other than in that one house, it's not going to be based on, okay, did you make our money back, right? Especially other publishers, if you're taking something wide for the next contract, they don't give a fuck if you made the money back for the other publisher. They just care if you sold 100,000 books or 500,000 books and whether they can, you know, make that work in their scheme for the next contract. And I have yet to see a circumstance or hear of a circumstance where taking more money actually gave you worse chances of getting more sales on a book or a contract, right? As a general rule, it seems that publishers are putting more effort, and it's not going to be 100% because shit falls through the cracks and shit bombs, but publishers put more effort and therefore your probability is higher of success the more money you get, because that publisher has put that money into you. They do have a P&L. They're tracking that, and at larger numbers, you can't just make that disappear. You can't fudge that, right? Whereas my, you know, a contract like mine, it doesn't matter. It's an afterthought on a P&L.
I don't know if I can keep this, but I do have a friend that a couple of years. I mean, I think we sold our books about the same time, and she actually turned down a bigger deal because the book went to auction. Turned down a bigger deal to work with a particular editor, who then left 3 months later. And yeah, it's like, well,
that story repeats a lot over the industry.
Yeah.
And then that person is just like gone from the industry, and you're an orphan, and your book's getting shunted around back and forth, and nobody seems to really know what's going on. And I just think
we see that a lot. I mean, I see your point, Scott. I mean, but the problem with that is that that what that does incentivizes authors to move around a lot. And I believe that a degree of loyalty should be rewarded. So the publisher will always use the P&L of previous books to justify the advance level. To be honest, they will always use it to justify paying as little as possible. Yeah. And I always fight against that. I think my point about the megabucks deals is it's particularly with debuts. It's a debut disease, this idea that you just throw money at somebody, and that's not always the best thing for that author. Now, more money equals better. More money equals the publisher has to work harder to recoup. I can't argue with that. But I'm talking about the authors. Because the thing is, as an agent, I care about the authors. I care about my authors deeply. Yeah. They're not just a machine where I push a button and the book comes out. They're human beings that I'm invested in emotionally as well as financially, experientially, whatever.
Yeah.
So if I look at them, and I have advised my clients to take underbidders deals, not because of a specific editor, but because the vision is better and I see a path to a sustainable career. So I think further into your career, if you want to play that game and hop from publisher to publisher, say, right, who's going to pay me the most? That probably is going to work, but very few authors get to that point.
Yeah.
Are in that position to do it. And the idea, and like I say, the part of the problem is that publishing always looks forward. Nobody ever goes back and has a look and says, look, how did all of these books pan out? What percentage of them have even washed their face? How many of these authors are still in the industry? Just nobody. And I'd love to do it. I mean, I don't have time. Maybe someday it'll be my magnum. My PhD thesis will be publishing. Publishing Failures. By Edward Wilson.
And I do agree with you, Ed. And especially, I don't think you're talking about a circumstance where it's a life-changing amount of money that somebody's turning down.
No.
I think
in the UK. America has life-changing sums of money.
Yeah. I do think there are plenty of instances where it does make sense to take slightly less money to get into, you know, the publishing house or into business with the editor who has the better vision and better fit, etc.
But But the thing that goes wrong is never the thing you think is going to go wrong. And that's the thing about publishing. It's like the random nature of it. The editor leaves or something else, or the publisher gets bought up, or you know, there's an Icelandic ash cloud or a pandemic. Like, there's always something. The thing that goes wrong is never the thing that you see coming down the track. Yeah. And we try and predict that. Who knows? God knows what's going to go wrong. Something's going to go wrong. And I say that to all my clients, even if you have the perfect trajectory, you write a brilliant book, you win an unpublished writer's prize, you get an agent, the agent of your dreams, you get the book deal of your dreams. At some point, something's going to go wrong.
You hear that, Richard?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all right. He doesn't listen very much.
No, we'll have to tell him in the chat that he's doomed for some reason. Yeah, one thing I do wish happened a little more on the agent side going to sub is like deep editor research and sharing that research. And I think some agents do that more than others, but looking at, you know, a particular book where you think that fits in the market, and then, okay, what editors have made a lot of money for authors with this kind of book. I know that data is kind of hard to track.
It's impossible to prove, because if a book is a success, you will find anybody who came within 5 miles of that book is just like, well, I mean, I was in the room when it was bought, clearly. I mean, that was my
opinion. Yeah.
The second a book has died, nobody is there. Like, that launch party is an empty room. The author's like, hang on, where is everybody? Why is nobody here? So everybody will take credit for a success, but nobody will own up. There are a couple of notable exceptions where an editor will say, I published that and I published that wrong. But those people tend not to get up to the top echelons of publishing.
Yeah.
So it is, I mean, what I'll do in my process, I will always bring together a submission list and I will share that with the author. Some authors are not interested, and that's totally fine. I respect that. Some authors just go down the rabbit hole. They are social media stalking the Jesus out of those editors, and they're finding out about it. And sometimes they'll come back to me and go, look, I think this person might not be the right one because of X, Y, and Z. And do you know what? I like having that conversation. I'm not expecting it, but I like that. Challenge me with the decisions that I'm making, because it's your career. You know, I want my authors to be informed, and I want them to be empowered to have a proper conversation with me about what it is I'm doing. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, it's not, I don't have to operate in darkness.
Yeah.
It's not some sort of shadowy agent cabal where it's like, no, you must ask no question. I know who Sonny's agent is. I don't know who yours is, Scott. But like, it doesn't have to be like that. Like, my authors can phone me up and ask me any question they want. Like, sometimes they don't want to hear the answers, but I'll tell them the answers. And I think part of it is about building that relationship. Like, it's a really fucking weird job, you know, because you are professionally and emotionally linked to somebody.
Yeah.
You know, at any given time, your author could run off with somebody else. Like, the insecurity part of it. And, you know, this is why agents have mental health problems just as much as writers and editors do. Because there is something very unsettling about it. Well, look, sorry, Scott is gesticulating wildly at me. Look, some agents are reptiles, like, just as like, but that's, but like, maybe they
so,
do.
So
but
to,
most of us.
So to clarify.
Most of us are human. Yeah. Most of us are human beings.
My
I'm a human being, Scott. If that is your real name.
It is. Scott's my real name. Drakeford is not. To clarify, my inaudible gestures in the background are not intended to besmirch agents. I just think that, well, maybe agents don't share their mental health issues as much as authors, but so many authors are deeply disturbed.
We're all stressed. Everybody's juggling.
Yeah.
I feel like everybody, like, the problem is there's become a kind of one-upmanship. It's just like, well, I'm stressed, I'm burnt out. No, you're not, that's nothing. I'm even more. Like, it's not a competition. Like, everybody's struggling. Everyone's had a shit couple of years and they're trying to kind of keep things going. You know? And I think I think it's really important just to be open about that. Like, tell your authors, tell your authors, be like, guys, I'm going to have to be a little bit off the radar for the next couple of weeks because I've got some stuff going on. Yeah. Like that communication, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think many people within the industry would see that as a sign of weakness. I personally don't. And that's why I work for myself and I don't work for a large corporate agency.
I do think that agents and editors probably would be very surprised. I will go so far as to suggest agents and editors should form some sort of secret alter ego, some online identity as a writer, and get into these secret discords that float around our industry. And
you think we don't? Come on.
Wake up, Scott. I have suspected.
Wake up, Scott.
I have suspected we had a mole for a while, but you might be surprised. But also, I feel the need to clarify as well that my agent is Matt Bialer, and he is one of the best humans on this earth, and I love him to death. So I my inaudible gestures were also not meant to besmirch him.
Sonny's going to be cutting that bit out.
No, he's a great guy.
And he's wildly successful. The time he takes with me is basically charity.
No, but I think there are loads and loads of agents who take it seriously. And I think that's part of it. So often I'll go into a competition for a particularly exciting author, and there'll be a bunch of us who are all after it. And usually I can tell who they are. They're the people you've mentioned. And to be honest, obviously I want them and I'm going to fight really hard. But If that writer chooses somebody else who I think is good, then I'm like, do you know what? That's fine. Yeah. If that writer chooses somebody who I don't think is good, then I'm just then I feel like I could have fought harder. I don't know what it is that I could have said. And sometimes writers pick the wrong agent.
Yeah.
And they make a mistake. And then 2 years later, I meet them at a party and I go, should have come with Teddy Boy. So I feel like that's okay. That's okay because not every, you can't represent every author.
Yeah.
And I think that something that perhaps when I was younger and when agents are younger, they want to sign every single writer. And that is completely unsustainable. Sometimes you have to accept that a writer can go with somebody else and that is okay because that's a good agent who is going to look after their career.
We touched briefly on authors being given a large amount of money and then going completely off the rails. And that has, we've seen that happen a few times recently. I guess a very notable example would be Kate Corrane got a shedload of money for her book. And I just wondered if you had thoughts on how the author ego informs that happening. I know that's a very broad question. I guess
the author ego. Look, there's a sliding scale.
Okay.
So writer, brilliant. So if you can imagine the axis, you've got how good a writer this person is, and then you've got the kind of the level of ego, and I think that you find people who have not achieved anything, have not written anything, but have already become like that persona, and sometimes they can bluster their way through. They fake it till they make it, and I think that's it. I don't want to be part of that journey because that scares the crap out of me. I think sometimes you want a writer who is really, really good but doesn't know it, because then a good agent can help them to believe in themselves and to believe in the writer that they become, and then you see their career go up. So along the way, I think most human beings, by the time they've written a book, I mean, unless you're some child prodigy, by the time a writer's written a book, they have fundamentally worked out who they are. And some people are dicks. Like that's a fact of humanity. Now, some of those people who I don't want to hang out with are writers. And I think that you have to take a fundamental view. Do I want to work with somebody? It doesn't matter. They're going to make me money. Yeah, they are. Do I want to be associated with them? Hell no. I would much rather have somebody who doesn't have the confidence but does have the talent, because I can help them and I can help them to believe in themselves. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So I don't think this idea that writers inevitably become monsters when they find success, I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true. I think they were always monsters.
Yeah, just in secret before.
There are right Yeah, just in secret. And just and there are writers who have no ego at all right at the start of their career, and they can sell a million books and they will still have no ego because they're just fundamentally decent human beings. Now, it's really hard to work out which is which, but I think as an agent just gets a sense. You get a sense early on whether the person you're dealing with is going to be the former or the latter. Part of it is about the support. Like part of it's about the support network. Mm. Like, do you have people around you who call you out, who bring you down to ground? You know, do you have people who you trust? You know, when and this is part of the problem. You know, your agent should be part of your team. And when you see somebody who, the first time they achieve success, they've started off with a smaller agent, the first time they achieve anything like success, they immediately bugger off to one of the big corporates.
Yeah.
Like, that's not good because those people are playing a different game. Yeah. Like, stick with the hometown agent. I mean, that's what I think. I believe in loyalty. I think I want to represent clients all the way through. You know, I think I've lost 3 clients in the whatever 18 years I've been an agent.
You ever turn anyone down?
3 clients have left me. Oh yeah, loads. I can't tell you about that. No, they've been too successful. But I've lost of the 3 clients. I think I cared about one of them. Two of them, it was the right call. But one of them, like, really, like, got to me. But I saw my boss, Andrew Hughes, an amazing man. He was Beryl Bainbridge's agent. He was Dick Francis's agent. William Trevor. Mm. Left and then came back because he'd made a mistake, you know, an incredible man. He represented people cradle to grave. Mm. And like, that's the way we run our agency. Cause that is, there should never be any question. That relationship needs to be rock solid, and providing a point of solidity for writers is quite rare, because you don't get the same editor all the way through your career, because editors have to jump around. Because publishers don't like to promote editors. They don't like to pay them more. So if you want to get ahead, you have to jump from publisher to publisher. So where is the point of solidity? Sure, it has to be at home with a partner, with a family, whatever. But also your agent can be that point of solidity. And that's what I try to do.
Yeah.
God, that sounded quite worthy, didn't it? We need to do, Scott, be rude to me. We need to have some...
No, I do. So I... Unlike probably most people listening to this podcast, though that's maybe an offensive generalization, I follow sports quite closely, American sports. And I do think about sports contracts. I don't know if it works the same in soccer or football.
Which sport are you talking about? I'm a big NFL fan.
So are you really? Okay, so NFL is a little different.
I'm a Chicago Bears fan, so I'm excited. Oh, we're finally going to have a decent – we finally have some players who can play. I'm okay, Sonny's just nodded.
Okay.
She was born in the U.S., so she
I've hated football for a long time.
some sports heritage there. I'm sorry about your Chicago Bears fandom. They're going to be bad for a really long time because Caleb Williams
they're
is
not
terrible. They just
he's a generation. He's a generational talent, and you will eat your words, Scott Drakeford.
I watched him play in college, and he's terrible. Anyway,
I've watched Rex Grossman, okay? I have watched Mitch Trubisky. Yeah. I will take Caleb Williams.
Yeah, that's true.
Any day.
Trubisky fucking sucks.
You don't know how deep the despair has gone.
But Justin Fields his decision making wasn't 100.
We broke him. We're not allowed nice things, but then Caleb is good enough.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, I mean, I'm a 49ers fan, and I had to live with my team selling their future for a third round or a third overall pick that they then traded immediately for nothing. But anyway, I'm thinking particularly about NBA contracts and how sports teams are incentivized to and you know, NFL falls into this, but they don't develop and keep as much maybe as NBA teams do. They're incentivized to develop their players that they draft because they have specific incentives granted by the league to keep those players long term over other teams that would like to poach them. Publishing tries somewhat to replicate that, but they do it by punishing the players or the authors, right? With non-competes, with right of first refusal. And I think, you know, going back to this theme that you've been hitting on a few times of systemic issues in the publishing industry, I would love to see publishing contracts, whether it comes from the agent or the publisher first, I would love to see contracts that pay agent or pay authors fairly, but do have some sort of kicker instead of, oh, we get to see this book first and we get to stall your career if we want to. I would love to see a clause that says something like, it's called bird rights in the NBA. I would love to see something that says, for your next contract, we reserve the right to pay 25% more than your next highest bidder, right? And what that does functionally is guarantees that your the publisher that secures your first deal, say it's from debut onward, right? They have the ability to retain you no matter what. So they know that they can keep your services over another publisher and their investments will be well served, even if they have to pay a little bit over what another publisher would. And they probably would anyway, because that's how auctions work. But also what this does is, at least in the NBA, is it leads to many, many, many of these good players just extending with their team ahead of auctions. And so they never even go to auctions, at least for their first few contracts, because they know that their team can outbid any other team. And they try to play nice. They try to keep each other happy because both sides know that they're stuck with each other. Whereas what happens now in publishing is you get a three-book deal, usually a three-book deal right now. You're probably underpaid unless you hit the hype train exactly right. And after that three-book deal, the chances are you're fucked. Like there.
That is a very depressing worldview you have, Scott. I feel like it's no, I can see. Okay, so allow me to shred your analogy. I mean, the thing about sports is it's got a very, there's a narrow window, yeah. Right? Young players yeah. come in, you get drafted in their yeah. lifespan. So yeah. that means it's much more concentrated. The beauty True. Of publishing is anybody at any age can write a book. I mean, I've got, if you look at the writers I've signed in the last 6 months, none of them are in their 20s, I yeah. don't think. I've got a wonderful food writer. I don't know how old he is. I haven't asked. It doesn't matter.
yeah.
But he's definitely north of 70. So like the points of entry are all the way through life and all the way through your kind of your career.
Yeah.
Whereas sport is much more focused on youth and coming through.
Yeah, sure.
The idea that a publisher can stall your career, that's bullshit. I'm sorry. Like the wording in option clauses, like sure, they try and put in all this stuff about being able to match offers. You just cut it out. Like most of it is anti-competitive. I mean, UK law is different to US, but you can't prevent somebody from leaving.
Do you cut it out of your contract?
Of course you do. Of course you do.
You don't have any non-competes.
You have an option.
Or right of first refusals in your agency contract.
The non-compete clause says you can't write the same book twice. Right, that's a pretty straightforward thing. Usually, in a three-book deal, you're not allowed to resell what comes next until the third book has been published or yeah. at least delivered. Beyond that. The publisher has the right to see it first, and I think that is correct. They have a right to see it first. They usually have a 30-day period where they can come to you and go, we want this, we want to keep it going. Once that's gone, you're off.
So,
and if the publisher doesn't want it or you don't want to, you can simply stall to do it. I don't think, like, I mean, we have, I don't know about restraint of trade, but, like, there's no way a publisher can actually stop you from moving an author. There's no way. There's no mechanism for that.
Mid-contract
they can, obviously,
yes.
because you're under contract.
Yes.
Once that contract comes to an end, once you've delivered the last book on the contract, at that point, you may have to tread water for a little bit, but it's going to be 30 days, 60 days, maybe 90 days. Most of the time, once that period has elapsed, then you can
do what
you like.
Can't they stall on accepting delivery? Because I feel like that's happened yeah. to a few people I know where the actual
yes.
acceptance has just dragged on for a couple of years at least.
Yes.
Yeah, but they have, but you see this again, you have to have wording that makes sure that they have a fixed time where they can accept. And if they don't accept, then they have to tell you why they're not. And they have to deliver, they need to give you in a certain number of words why it is that they're not accepting. You then have a period of time where you can revise the manuscript and resubmit it. Like there's, you've just got to be, it's a contract. Like,
yeah.
So you need a good agent, basically.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes.
Why don't you, like, if you're not defining the terms in your contract properly, then yeah, sure, you'll get tied up in knots. Most of the time, the publishers will drag things out, but if they don't want to continue with the writer, or if they're not going to offer enough money, then you just have to work out how to trigger the right points, and then off you go.
So where it gets heinous, and I love to hear that, you know, you've solved for this in your contracts, but many author contracts that we've seen are not that well put together. And this is from very large agencies, right? And agencies that presumably have their shit together. For example, you know, you say, great, you can't publish anything during a contract. Well, say that contract has been delayed often through, by the publisher and not by the author. And many of these non-competes and or right of first refusal, which are aimed at basically the same thing, have a clause in there that allows the publisher to look at that exclusively up until 30 days after you give it to them, or 30 days after they publish the last work that they had contracted for in the last contract. So you could be tied up for years. And it's not uncommon for many authors, especially in the debut stage, and especially if they want to write in multiple genres, right? So take me, for example. I published an epic fantasy. I want to write historic fantasy. I want to write historic fiction, etc. If my contract says for any work of fiction that my publisher has a right of first refusal and non-compete through the end of that contract being published, I then am beholden to them. And it may not hold up in court, but I don't want to go to court. Well, maybe I do. But most people
sloppy
don't.
Drafting, Scott. It's sloppy drafting. So you define it. So you do. So if I've got a writer who's writing epic fantasy under the name Scott Drakeford, then his option clause says you have the first refusal over the next work of epic fantasy written by Scott under the name Scott Drakeford.
Yes. Yes.
Very, very simple.
Yes.
Like, there's no reason not to have that. It protects the publisher. Yep. I'm not trying to pull a fast one on publishers. Like, I think they should have every right to do it. If Scott Drakeford decides he wants to go and write some lurid erotica under a different name, why should the publisher be able to prevent them from doing that? There's no reason to. So it's all about being specific.
Yeah, functionally, I don't think they can, even with a bad contract. And you are absolutely correct. It is all about being specific in these contracts. However, my point is that those contracts are out there right now. They're being signed by authors right now. And it's something that, a lot of agents, I think, maybe even especially agents that have been in the game for a long time, they haven't run up against issues on a lot of these things for years and years and years, because a lot of authors just write what they write and they stay in their lane and they stay with their publisher when it goes well and great, right? But it is something that I think authors should be paying more attention to in this day and age, where it seems like contracts and publisher relationships are a little bit more volatile.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you should always make sure that the contractual terms are relevant to what you're doing.
Yeah.
I don't think the publishers are trying to tie up writers. It's very rare that they do. And there's most of the time, if an author has done well, the publisher will want to reward them, and it makes sense for them to continue controlling that person's publication, so because they're going to be able to make more money out of the backlist, and it all kind of works together. The danger then is if somebody has an ulterior motive to try and move them, and you do see this from time to time. What is in the best interest of the writer? Often staying with that publisher, being in control of their backlist, getting their royalties from the same person, having everything pushing in one direction, moving around for the sake of it. To go get you back to your sports analogy, part of the problem now is that you have large corporate agencies that do the NBA contracts, that do NFL contracts, that do massive actors' film deals, and then they have to apply the same rationale to that to someone's £10,000 advance. Like, they're not the same thing.
Yeah.
That's why we're not a small agency. We're kind of medium sized, I would say. That's why we focus on books, and we're really good at it. We know books because the context for our deals are other deals we've done for writers for their books.
Yeah.
We're not taking precedence from, Ryan Reynolds's latest film and trying to apply that to somebody who's doing a poetry collection with Carcanet. That's madness.
Shout out WME, huh?
I'm not going to badmouth anybody. I love some people who work at WME. I'm not here to settle scores, Scott. That's not what I'm about. But so, I personally think that a big corporate agency is always going to have a slightly different game in mind. And if you're a writer starting out, go with a book person. Stick with a book person. Book people know that. Somebody who reads. I inherited an author who'd been represented by one of the big multi-talent groups. And he confessed to me that he didn't think his agent had ever read one of his books. Wow. I was like, that's depressing. Like, the very least I can do is read your bloody book. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I might not like it, and I'll tell you I don't like it if that's the case. Yeah. But I'm going to read it.
Yeah. And one of the things that Sunyi and I have talked about a lot on and off air is that publishing success is almost entirely determined by the publisher, right? And by what they do. Obviously, there's a bar of quality, there's a bar of applicability to audiences, whatever. But that publisher efforts, by and large, determine the sales outcome, at least, of any given book. And so given that that's the fact, and given that an author brand is almost always built by a publisher in trad, not the same for indie, obviously, I do think there is a lot of cause for publishers to want to maintain some sort of grip on that author. And I think more should be done. And I think authors would like for more to be done to retain them at the same publishing house. I just think it has to start from the beginning and, you know, probably starts with bigger deals that are acted upon.
Yeah. I can see that. Yeah. I can see that. And I think that again, this goes back to my PhD about great publishing failures. Like, I would be really interested to know what happened and what the variables are.
Yeah.
Whether it is an editor who disappears at a critical moment during the publishing process, whether it is a takeover, whether there's some disruption at the agency, a competing work. There were so many variables. I mean, this is part of it. Like, it's the random nature of publishing.
Yep.
But that's not just publishing. That's creative industries. Like, if you want a sure thing, like, go and be an accountant.
Yep.
That's fine.
Yep.
Like, that way you work hard, you pass your exams, you go up, you follow up a career path. Like, that's not what publishing is.
Yeah.
Like, there is a randomness that makes it so exciting and why people want to do it. And the thing I say, I do a lot of talks. Like I said, I'm very passionate about demystifying. None of this stuff needs to be secret. Like, people should understand how the industry works. But there's no other creative endeavor where the expectation is to professionalize it, right?
Yeah.
So if you play the piano, you're not expecting to get a record deal with Decca. You're not expecting to play Carnegie Hall. If you're a painter, you're not expecting to get signed by the Saatchi Gallery and to have international exhibitions. Why is the only bar for success in publishing to be published? Some people write and they just love writing. They're really good at it. They do it for themselves, for their family, whatever. That should be enough. And I think that the idea that the only way that you can succeed as a writer is to sell a million copies and get a number one bestseller. Yeah, obviously that is an indication of success. But there are people who don't do that who can be satisfied by being a writer. And I think that publishing should respect that. Sometimes you can be an unpublished writer and be happy with what you're doing and be good at what you're doing. And that's enough.
So, I mean,
I think I've just blown Scott's mind.
Oh, sorry. I think he's highlighting our shared document.
Oh, no.
You
two are having a secret chat. I can't believe it.
Secret chats within secret chats.
You're ganging. Oh, my God. You're ganging up.
We'll try
up
not
on
to
me.
Keep you all evening, but I did want to go back and say, you know, we talked a bit before the recording started where you were saying you had this idea of advances being capped. And I wondered if you felt like going into that, you know, when we're talking about how much should publishers pay for a book? What is achievable?
Oh, it wouldn't work. It's a lovely
okay.
it's a lovely idea. Like, the idea of having a salary cap for a debut deal, like a rookie wage scale they have in the NFL.
Yep.
But the only way you could do that is also by having a minimum wage. And I was discussing this with one of my crime writers, and she said you can only do that if you have a minimum wage. Do you know what? If there was a way to do that that was competitive, and that everyone would agree with, that'd be amazing. The idea that you lose the bottom. The idea that writers can be destitute. Mm. Like, I think that's it. Maybe this is part of the kind of whatever the universal. There's a theory that everybody should have like a universal basic income. Why shouldn't you apply that to writing? That if somebody, again, you'd have to find a way that they could qualify, so that they're good enough. You're doing inverted commas. They're good enough to qualify, but I don't know. But, I don't know. Part of me feels that I look at the imbalance and I think we don't have to do it this way.
Yeah. WGA.
We really don't.
WGA for the Screenwriters Guild does effectively this, right? They have a minimum hourly wage that people can pay screenwriters, I think, right? They have a minimum amount. I don't know that they have caps, though.
No. Well, you probably got, and like I say, it's probably not enforceable, but I think that it's screenwriting slightly different because a novel can take a different, it's much easier to quantify like what an hour means in screenwriting time.
Sure.
Well, part of the problem is that writers aren't unionized. Like there is no WGA for novelists.
Yep.
I think over here, I think people in publishing can sign up to the NUJ, so the Journalists Union, but there isn't really a right. The Society of Authors tries and represents that and does some lobbying in the kind of effectively in that space.
Yeah, the Society of Authors are about it.
I'm not going to. I don't think it's going to work. But I would love the idea that you somehow remove the possibility that people can get really shat on, and that if somebody wants to be a writer, that they would have the ability to at least expect a quality of life.
So, amen.
Very quickly, and then I'll ask you our Petty Hill question. So what do you think is the best strategy for an author of any tenure to score a livable deal? That's actually Scott's question that I've stolen.
I think you need to have an agent that understands your needs rather than understanding their own ability to their desire to hit targets. I think you need to have somebody that you can have an open conversation with and explain, like, this is my life, this is the shape of my life, this is what I need to be able to do this, and if you can't get me that, then I'm not going to be able to do this. I'm going to have to go and find something else. And I think that openness, I think, you know, Americans, sorry, I'm going to cast aspersions about your great nation. Americans are much better at talking about money than Brits are. We're very bad at talking about money. This idea that you would have an open conversation with somebody about how much you earn, like, is nonsense, whereas it's something my American friends will do quite happily. So I think you need to understand what your needs are, understand how that intersects, like real life intersects with your creative life. You need to find the Goldilocks zone within that, where you're being paid enough that you can actually do the things you want to do, but there isn't, if you get to the upper echelons, then that's a wonderful thing, but there's not an expectation. I think you should be able to live first, and then you should be able to write what you want to when you want to, and if that leads to great success, then that's wonderful. But if it doesn't, it doesn't mean you're a failure. You can be happy writing books that you're proud of that are not commercially successful.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone in the industry ever says that.
I mean, he's just described poets, right?
Hey, come on. Do you know what? Okay, I'm going to tell you about poets. I'm going to tell you about Jenny Joseph. Jenny Joseph, she was about six, she was about 4'8". She wrote a poem called Warning. It starts, "When I'm an old woman, I will wear purple." She lived off that poem. So you can do it. So we had a poem. It's wonderful. She used to communicate entirely by fax.
Wow. Yeah, I was going to say, in what era was this?
She died. I mean, Jenny didn't die that long ago, by like 2016. Like this is a recent thing. And she was absolutely brilliant. So, like, you know, I'm not going to cast aspersions about poets. But I think like creativity is a weird thing. Like people have different motivations and different reasons they go into it. One of the premises, I mean, is of the podcast is that getting the big bucks is the only success. And I just don't agree with that.
I mean, I need
people to get paid in order to have a functioning business myself. But I don't think that's the only thing. I've got authors who don't make lots of money, but are really, really happy.
I don't think it's the only path, but I do think it increases your chances. And I think particularly for Scott and I, for different reasons, we are very money motivated. Me, because I don't want to go back to being on the dole. You know, it's much better to have an income. And Scott, because, I don't know, you want to take over the world or something. So I think for us particularly, it is a factor.
Well, 'cause teeth like those don't come for free.
Funny story, I had braces twice in my life, so they don't come with my genetics either.
You worked hard. You worked hard for those two.
I mean, my parents paid for it, yeah. Anyway, so I agree with you, Ed. I think there, you know, obviously it's an art. There is a lot to be said for treating it as an art. However, I think our discussions on the podcast are specifically aimed at trad publishing and making a living in trad publishing, even if it's not getting rich, which I think everybody who wants, well, not everybody who wants, everybody who's producing something that's worthy of making a lot of money should make that money, right? Is what I will say on that. But I think making a living, if you get to that bar of quality, that bar of sellability that you mentioned, I think is something that we as an industry should shoot for and that we're trying to advocate for. And
yeah, totally agree.
Yeah. One thing I'll mention on that, because I think we're probably pushing time, is just that the industry does make money, right? The number of publishers who lose money is quite small compared to most other industries, right? The recent numbers I've seen, I haven't followed numbers all the way back, but the most recent report I saw in Publishers Marketplace basically reported a 10% profit margin across the board with the big publishers, right? With the big five parent companies. What that tells me, if it's 10% across the board, that tells me that not only obviously does every publishing house work approximately the same, but that also tells me that they're gaming those numbers, right? And the other thing that tells me that they're gaming those numbers is that when Simon & Schuster wanted to sell first to PRH and then to KKR, they magically boosted their profit percentage to 30%, which is very attractive in most industries, right? And so that tells me that they're doing some accounting fuckery on the back end to get their numbers to 10% so that they're not paying as much in taxes, which, fair, that's the way the world works. But the industry makes money.
We're into conspiracy theories now.
That's not conspiracy theories. That's just how corporations work. They try to maximize the amount of money they make while minimizing the amount of taxes they pay, right? But the point is, the industry makes money, right? Each of these companies, especially these parent companies, are multi-billion-dollar companies. Many, I actually should go back and look. But if I'm not mistaken, they're making several billions at least each per year, and they're operating at a profit percentage that's somewhere between 10 and 30%. So it's not an industry that's strapped for cash. I'm sure the executives have private planes. It's not an industry that's incapable of establishing something like this minimum bar payment and being a little bit more sensical when it comes to author careers.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. I mean, we see time and time again, publisher announces record profits, publisher announces job cuts, and you're just like, I don't understand. And there's usually a very nice statement that says, we're looking at the path ahead and we're realizing there's tough times ahead and we're going to streamline those. Now, the tough times never seem to come. They just want to get rid of a few people in the back office. Now, it's never the executive salaries that get, like very rarely do the people at the top of the publisher get sacked. It's always going to be, right, you're going to share an assistant now.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, hang on. It's like, oh, so we're gonna slim down production. We're gonna put one publicist going across three imprints instead of across two.
Yeah.
And I think that's deeply unfair. But I mean, your criticism is essentially one of capitalism. And sadly, although the power and reach of this podcast is vast, I think taking down the fundamental tenets of capitalism is beyond even your reach.
Just step one, Ed. Step one. It's early days.
Early days. We're going to keep with those. We can achieve anything if we try. We're now going to hold hands and sing. I like this.
We're still in our 30s. We're good.
Before your spouse gets mad at you for staying too long, this is the part of the podcast where I get to ask guests what is either the pettiest grievance you're willing to share or the pettiest hill you're willing to die on.
Now, you see, I had a conversation with Alex Darwin about this earlier, that I do actually have three hills that I'm prepared to die on. And I'm not sure. I don't know whether I should. I think one of them I definitely shouldn't say. Two of them, I'm willing to give you the option of which you'd like. One of them is book scan, which I think is bullshit.
We hate it too.
The idea, it's skewed towards the successful. The idea, I look at book scan numbers for anybody above the very, very top author, and they are, we're looking at like 50-60% of coverage. Like, and they don't care about that. They don't care because they use it. And you have bonuses based on book scan. You have publishers doing their numbers based on book scan.
Acquisitions.
And you're saying, gross it up, gross it up. it's nonsense. You know, every time I do like a proper forensic look and I compare the gross to the to what's on BookScan, I'm flabbergasted by how shit the coverage is. Anyway, yes. BookScan's one of them. And the other one is people in publishing writing books, which I'm just getting bored of now. I'm getting bored. I spend my entire time going up and down the country talking to writers, going, publishing is not a closed loop. We're looking for new writers. Sorry. It's the dog agrees.
Sorry.
The dog agrees. I am delighted. I think it's brilliant. I think it's brilliant that publishing is full of creative people. And I think that if you want to write a book, then that's a wonderful thing. If you want to get some experience in publishing and then go off and be an author, that's great. What I don't want is the publishing spending its resources on other people who work in publishing, because it just, it's so inward looking. And it makes me crazy. Like every time I've gone and given a talk and said, send us your books. We're looking for new blood. The bookseller has like four pages of editor writes book and gets paid £150,000. It's a really bad look, because what happens is you have lots of editorial assistants who should be learning how to be editors are actually secretly sitting at their desk writing their novel.
It's funny, I nearly asked you about that in the conversation and I couldn't figure out a way of getting into it, and I wasn't sure you'd be willing to discuss it. But yeah, I mean, I will say the authors notice. They, you know, at least the authors I know, we notice when editors sell books to editors for absurd amounts of money, and it's not a good look.
It's not a good look. And that's not to say I'm not denigrating the talent of any of these people. And I'm not, there's some of people I would consider to be my friends who can do both. And do you know what? If it's cross-genre, if you're an agent who specializes in X and you've written some books that are a totally different genre, there's no overlap at all, then you can kind of say there's enough separation. But when you have somebody who is functioning within a specific area of publishing and writes a book in that area, you're always going to get the advantage. You're already on the inside. Yeah. And I just do your job. Just do your job. Don't do the next person. Don't be the poacher and the gamekeeper. Like, don't, there is the expectation that you get paid for both simultaneously. In what other industry would that happen?
Yeah. Yep.
Like, are you going to be the Grand Prix driver, but you're also going to be the car? Like, that's not going to work. You have to, you choose the one thing you're at and do that. Focus on that.
So I'm adding this in as an additional bit to the podcast, just because we forgot to give Ed a chance to plug himself and ended up going into a discussion that had to be off record. But if you want to find Ed, you can look for him at his website, www.johnsonandalcock.co.uk, or you can find him on Twitter at literaryhore, all one word. Yes, it is spelled in that way. And I'll put links into the show notes for anyone who's looking for them. Anyway, thank you again for listening to Publishing Radio. You've been listening to the Publishing Radio podcast with Sunny Dean and Scott Drakeford. Tune in next time for more in-depth discussion on everything publishing industry. See you later.